What is up, cyber and crypto homies? Today is Wednesday, October 30th of 2024. This is episode number 120 of the Cybersecurity and Cryptocurrency Podcast. I am your host, Eric English. All the views and opinions on this podcast are solely my opinions and do not reflect the opinions of my employer. If you want to follow me on X, I'm at CyberCryptoGuy. All right, so some interesting stuff to run through today in the cybersecurity world. I wanted to talk a little bit about CASBs and proxy solutions that are out there and some pitfalls and things to watch out for with those. Also wanted to talk a little bit about Microsoft Entra ID and their new MFA mandatory rollout that they're doing. And then also some additional settings in Exchange Online for SMTP DANE as well as DNS SEC. There's also some other items I wanted to discuss on the cybersecurity side too, but I may have to save those for the next one. So see if we can get to it here today. On the cryptocurrency side of things, we're going to talk a little bit about MicroStrategy, some news about them, some more FTX fallout news as well. And then of course we'll run through the profits of Bitcoin here lately and the pricing and where things are going there. All right, so to kick things off, I think we'll start with the Microsoft Entra ID mandatory MFA that's rolling out. So to me, this is a long time coming. I don't know why this hasn't been mandatory for years. I mean, multi-factor is kind of a staple now. And now we're kind of moving into, you know, we're getting away from passwords in a lot of instances, and we're going to pass keys. So regardless, though, I think that MFA should have been the default and enforced for everyone in Entra ID for a long time. It is coming now for everybody, and it is going to be enabled by default by Microsoft if you do not take action yourself. So this is something that if you have Entra ID that you need to be aware of, make sure that, you know, the policy that Microsoft is trying to implement is going to work for your organization. Make sure that you are aware of those settings and how it's going to affect your user base. And you may have to create some exceptions for things like service accounts and other accounts that may not work if you have MFA turned on. So let's discuss those like service account related questions. I think that is where there's so much risk with service accounts, especially in a cloud-based platform and with no MFA, that can be very scary. So really, to make an exception like that, you really want to put in some other controls, some other mitigating controls around those service accounts that, you know, can at least help to mitigate some of the risk of not having MFA. And what I'm thinking of there specifically is conditional access policies. So basically putting those service accounts in a conditional access policy that either limits where they can log into based on geolocation or IP address. I would also highly recommend for those service accounts that you make those passwords ridiculously long, you know, 40 characters plus. That way they are not easily guessed or brute forced, of course. But really those geo restrictions and IP restrictions in a conditional access policy could really help. I think the geo restrictions are a lot more broad, so you could limit it to only being able to log in from the United States, for example. However, there's a lot of IP addresses in the United States. There's a lot of, you know, VPNs that bad guys can get into in the United States and try to hack those accounts. So that's when, you know, locking down those service accounts by IP address with a conditional access policy is probably your next best bet, I would say, to make sure that those service accounts only log into or only log in from very specific IP addresses that you know what they are. And that way you can just really control the access on those accounts. So, and this would go for like any other kind of like shared accounts that you may have or generic accounts. So really just want to make sure that, you know, we're staying on top of these and making sure that those accounts stay secure. Now, the other trick here too is there's always some risk with, and I think I mentioned this a few episodes ago, with syncing all of your Active Directory accounts to Azure or Entra ID. And by the way, can we call it intra and not entra? I hear people saying entra ID all the time. Do you enter a building or do you enter a building? I personally enter a building. I don't enter a building. It's intra ID, not entra ID. That kind of thing drives me crazy. My last name's English, so I guess I'm supposed to be annoyed by that, but the other one, too, is Azure, all the names that we give Azure. Azure, when we try to make it sound fancier than it really is. It's just Azure. Like, let's not make it sound like it's some, you know, super fancy word. It's Azure. It's intra ID. Anyway, for those generic accounts, the service accounts, and any other accounts that you're syncing out to intra ID, well, the problem there is, like, especially with, you know, accounts that aren't necessarily, you know, cloud used in the cloud, essentially, or used or authenticated from intra ID. Let's say it's an on-prem service account that you guys use internally, but it got synced to intra ID because you're syncing everything to intra ID. Well, this is where it opens up some external risk for those accounts, especially if no one logs into those accounts from Azure or intra and sets up the MFA. And so you can imagine you set up what you think is an internal Active Directory account with, you know, kind of a crappy password. You think, it's no big deal. It's just going to be used internally. But wait, it synchronizes to intra ID. Now that account with that crappy password can be accessed from an external third party. Yes, you have to guess the account name. I get that. But given a successful guess of the account name and password, that's a very easy thing for a hacker to get into, especially when no one has set up or configured the MFA. So this is also something you want to look at and run reports out of intra ID and see which accounts, number one, are not in use. So what accounts have not been logged into in the last like 30 days, for example? If you're not logging into the account, you know, I mean, it's less than every 30 days, you might want to disable it or, you know, remove it from syncing to intra ID. So just really want to make sure we highlight that because there could be tons of accounts out there that are synced to intra ID that no one has configured MFA on. So run those reports from intra ID, see which accounts are in use and which ones aren't in use, and then run a report on which accounts do not have MFA configured. If they do not have MFA configured, all a bad guy has to do is guess the username and password, and then they're in, and then they can configure the MFA however they so choose. Really, the ideal scenario here is to create OUs in on-prem Active Directory, assuming you're in hybrid setup, and in those specific OUs, you would have accounts that you want to sync to intra ID. If there's, you know, accounts that you set up on-prem that do not need to sync to intra ID, put them into a different OU that you do not use dir-sync with and make sure that they do not populate to intra ID. So, but again, going back to this Microsoft article here, they are going to implement this, looks like on December 2nd. Specifically for newly created tenants starting on December 2nd. So they'll begin rolling that out for any new tenants. But for everyone else who has an existing tenant in Azure or Intra ID, those will start in January of 2025. So you got a few months here, and this is going to be mandatory. So again, just go in and make sure that you've got it set up the way you want. Make sure that you've got, you know, accounts out there that are actually being used. Remove the accounts that you're not using. Unsync the OUs that you don't need out there. Make sure there's not an account sitting out there with MFA not configured as well. So again, just make sure you're checking all those things in your intra ID setup and make sure it's as secure as you can possibly make it. Another new-ish thing that I just saw here for Office 365, specifically for Exchange Online, Microsoft is rolling out what's called inbound SMTP DANE with DNSSEC. I guess that's already been implemented for several of the Outlook email domains, and they're rolling it out to Outlook and Hotmail domains, and they're expected to complete that by the end of this year. So this is, of course, also going to populate over to your Office 365 tenants as well. So personally, it looks like also to May 2025 is the mandatory outbound SMTP Dane setup per tenant that they're going to roll out here. So again, these are good target dates to be aware of here, and make sure you study up on what SMTP Dane is. Personally, this is the first time I've actually seen this, so I got to do some studying up on this myself. DNSSEC I've heard of for quite a while. The interesting thing about DNSSEC is I don't know of a lot of organizations that actually have this configured. Now I get it. It's important, right, for protecting your DNS records on the web. So I understand why it's there. I just don't know of a lot of companies that have actually done it. And I don't know what the overhead is on it, what the maintenance is like with it. If it's like a one-time setup and you're done, or is this something you always have to babysit and check in on. But personally, I got to do some research myself, and I'll certainly report back with what I learn about it, about both of these settings, DNSSEC and SMTP Dane. And I'll come back with, you know, my analysis on this. But either way, I want to at least make everyone aware that Microsoft is targeting a mandatory outbound SMTP Dane be set per tenant or per remote domain. So these are all things to just be aware of and make sure that you're ready for these target dates are coming up. So May 2025... looks like that's going to be mandatory. Some other cybersecurity-related stuff I wanted to talk about. And by the way, sorry, my voice is kind of crappy today. I'm a little bit under the weather this week, but I'm fighting through it as best I can. Every day is a Super Bowl, so here we go. But did want to talk about proxies and CASBs and some of the pitfalls there. I think that, you know, a lot of sales pitches you'll hear from these CASB solutions, you hear all the, you know, the great stuff, there's no issues, everything works. However, that's not always the case. And, you know, there are, you know, Palo Altos, there are Netskopes, there are Zscaler companies like that that do proxy, SSL decryption, CASB-like functionality. Some of the limitations that I think that the salespeople don't mention enough about these tools are specifically one of the biggest ones that I ran into personally was with certificate pinned applications. So what is certificate pinning? Well, when you run your traffic through an SSL decryption of some kind and you're inspecting the traffic, you have to then re-encrypt that traffic with a different certificate, right, and send it to the destination or to the recipient. And therein lies the problem. If the application is certificate pinned, the recipient is expecting the same cert that they issued, not a cert that you have re-encrypted that traffic with. So that recipient will then deny that traffic and your application will no longer work. So I can think of a lot of examples of certificate pinned applications. A lot of these happen to be like desktop client software. So like if you have a Google Drive client, the actual desktop client, or a Dropbox desktop client, or a OneDrive desktop client, things of that nature are typically certificate pinned. Now there are some web applications too that are certificate pinned. And you can find some lists out there from Zscaler and Netskope and others like that of all these certificate pinned applications. So certificate pinning means that you have to then bypass your CASB or your proxy because you can't send it through there and decrypt and then re-encrypt with a new cert because they won't accept that. That application won't accept it. So you have to make exclusions or exceptions for those applications that are certificate pinned. Well, the whole point of having a CASB or a proxy like this and doing the SSL decryption is to have DLP. That's really what you're shooting for, data loss prevention. I want to look at what data is going out. I want to decrypt, inspect the traffic, see what data is going out, see if it's PII, see if it's customer data, see whatever it is, and then make sure that whatever that data is that's sensitive is going to a place that you want to allow it to go, right? It's not going to someone's personal, you know, Yahoo email or something. It's not going to their personal Google Drive or whatever, right? You want to make sure that that PII is going to, you know, your HR platform, for example, or it's going to specific people in HR or whatever it is, right? You want to make sure that you're protecting that data. That's the whole point of the CASB. Well, if you have to make all of these exceptions in the CASB for these certificate pinned applications, how do you protect that data? And to me, that's always been the issue. It's, you know, and there's really I haven't gotten a lot of great answers, unfortunately, from a lot of these vendors about this. They always point to plugging into the API of whatever that cloud application is. So let's say you're using Dropbox as an example. Well, Dropbox is certificate pin. Okay, how do I protect my data? Oh, well, you have to plug into the API, and we can kind of scan, you know, via the API. Well, that's great and all. However, you want to stop that traffic from, or that data from being exfiltrated, you know, in the process, right? You don't want to catch it after the fact via the API. So that's where you've got some limitations there, and the list of certificate pinned applications is quite large. I mean, it's not a small, tiny little list of apps. It's not like 10 applications. There's over 100, and some of them are the very big popular applications. So when you're evaluating a CASB solution like that, make sure that you ask those questions about certificate pinned applications, and then review what applications you have in your organization that are certificate pinned that you will have to make proxy and CASB exceptions for and let them bypass your CASB. So, you know, really you want to get the full value out of that CASB and not, you know, bypass anything, but you need your applications to also work. Right. So that's always the trade-off here. So just make sure that you don't have like a super big use case with like a Dropbox. Like if that's your primary file storage and it's certificate pinned and you can't do inline CASB, that's, you know, that's kind of a deal breaker, right? I mean, sure, you can prevent it from going to other, you know, sources, right? So it's not a complete deal breaker, but that could be certainly a big, you know, a big issue, right, to think about, right? So just look at the applications that you have at your org, make sure that, you know, not very many of them are certificate pinned. And also the trick there too with DLP, the whole reason you have CASB is for DLP, right? Well, DLP has a lot of false positives, and that's the other really big challenge here is how do I eliminate false positives? Because just trying to trigger on PII, for example, is very difficult, and you're going to get a ton of false positives, right? Because it's going to pick up on every email signature with a name and address and a phone number. Oh my God, that's PII. Well, that's, you know, it's just an email signature, right? So it's not easy to configure the DLP in such a way. Now, what worked for some of the things that I did is we had specific file names, or we were able to tag files using a, you know, like a tag from Microsoft, for example. So if you're using, and I'm forgetting the name of the product now, Purview, I believe it is, and you're able to do data classification through Purview and tag those documents, then you can trigger on those tags in a proxy CASB solution. Without that tagging, though, you're kind of relying on strings of, you know, numbers. Oh, that looks like a credit card. Oh, that looks like PII. Oh, it looks like a social. But in a lot of cases, it could just be a phone number. It could be a email signature. Who knows, right? So there's a lot of false positives with DLP, and DLP is very difficult to fine-tune. However, if you can get to that level with it and do all that data classification and be able to trigger on those things and make sure that people are labeling their data correctly, that's the other trick there, then yeah, those CASBs and proxies are a great option. But I wanted to highlight that because I think that gets overlooked a lot with the sales pitches that you hear from these companies. They just kind of skim right over that. And when you ask them about it, they're like, oh yeah, well, those are hard to deal with. Well, yeah, it is. Well, so what do I do? And so you have to make exceptions, right? So there are also instances where I've seen the proxy and CASB create issues with agents that are installed. So similar to like a Dropbox client, right? Well, you've got a CrowdStrike agent. You've got a, you know, whatever other kind of Tenable, you know, vulnerability scanner agent or whatever it is, Rapids, it could be any of them. And all of a sudden, those agents are having SSL errors. They're not able to check into the console and report on, you know, security risks and vulnerabilities and threats and all that kind of stuff. And oh, yeah, oh, by the way, you have to make exceptions for those too in your CASB, right? So there's just a lot of exceptions. And those exceptions are going around and bypassing your CASB. So just be aware of those, I think, more than anything, because that's not something that's brought up typically in those sales pitches. I think I'll jump over to the crypto side of the world. I think that there's a couple of interesting topics here to talk about there. So MicroStrategy, they just keep buying and buying and buying Bitcoin. Looks like they're trying to raise another $42 billion to buy more Bitcoin over the next 3 years. I mean, whew, they've already got a whole crap ton of this as it is, but it's incredible how much how much they have here, but they're going to keep trying to add to it, it looks like. And really, there's just no end in sight. It's interesting to see like a company that's doing this, but they've bought in at such low rates. They're actually, you know, way, way up as far as what they bought in at. They bought in, you know, like at $39,000 for some of their stuff. And heck, we were up at like $72,000 just today, I believe it was. So, I mean, they've already doubled their money in that instance, right? So they've definitely made a whole bunch of profits, but it's just interesting to see that they're going to keep buying and keep buying and keep buying. So I guess that's good news for Bitcoin. It's just interesting to see how much that they keep buying, but they're clearly making a ton off of this. So maybe it's not such a bad strategy, but I guess they're calling themselves a Bitcoin treasury company. So yeah, they're just going to keep stockpiling Bitcoin as a treasury reserve asset and just try to get as much profit out of it as they possibly can, which they have certainly been doing pretty well with so far. So some of their total Bitcoin holdings, it looks like they have 252,220 Bitcoins for a total of about $9.9 billion. And they've purchased at an average price of $39,266. Woo-wee! Talk about making some money there, right? I think I'm going to check the price here in just a second. Looks like as of today, we're at $72,379. So as of right this moment. So they bought in on average at $39,000. We're up at $72,000. Yeah, they've almost doubled their money. They're making quite the profit there, so I guess kudos to them for doing what they're doing, because it's working. And we'll see how much more they continue to stockpile. But interesting just to see those companies that are stockpiling this too. And you have all the climate advocates that say how bad Bitcoin is for the environment and all these things. And I can't say that I disagree too much. However, if you take a look at AI and you want to compare that to the crypto mining, very, very similar as far as power consumption goes. And in some cases, it may even be more for powering all these AI learning models that we're creating. You know, in some cases, they're building data centers with millions of GPUs that do nothing but sit there and crunch away at data. And that's very similar to how you mine crypto, right? You used to be able to mine with GPUs. Now you have to get ASIC miners, but very similar concept, except one is training an AI model and the other is mining for crypto. So I think actually AI may overtake cryptocurrency as far as, you know, being bad for the climate and being bad for the environment. That's my opinion, at least. And I think that that's very well on its way, especially if we continue as far as we think we're going to continue with all this AI fun stuff. So that's something to keep an eye on, too, for all the climate advocates out there. I'm a climate advocate, too. I don't want to live in an inferno on Earth with, you know, global warming or whatever the heck's happening. Certainly don't want to live through that or have, you know, children and family that live through that kind of thing either, right? And so if there's climate issues, we need to address them. This is not a political show or a climate show by any means, but these are things we can't ignore. There are, you know, proven facts out there. But anyway, I'm going to leave that alone and go back to, I think AI is going to be much more power heavy and much more power consumption in comparison, especially now that a lot of the cryptos are going to proof of stake, where it's, you know, we're not mining anymore. We are staking or holding our crypto in our wallet. And that staking is effectively using your staked or saved funds to fund other transactions on the blockchain. And for temporarily funding those transactions, you get a little reward. So, you know, very similar to, you know, interest at your bank account, right? If you put in a CD at the bank that's going to make, you know, 5% interest over 5 years, well, they're probably going to use those funds in the meantime for other things, right, to get you that 5% return. This is very similar in crypto. We're staking our crypto in a wallet to make those little returns on it. So, but, you know, I digress. I think AI, though, is still going to be much more climate intensive. And I don't see Bitcoin going proof of stake anytime soon. However, Ethereum has, and they were the second biggest one. So I think a lot of others are already starting to follow suit. And I think that trend will continue because mining is just, it's unsustainable over time, right? It starts out very easy, and then all of a sudden it gets to this difficulty level where nobody can mine it, essentially. But without having specialized hardware. But I digress even more again. But that's all the fun stuff, I think, on the crypto side that I wanted to touch on, at least today. I did also want to, just in general, talk about, you know, work-related, I guess, productivity. And there seems to be so much nowadays where things are planned to the level that is over-planning at times, and we plan and we plan and we plan. And the actual work that we do at the end of all that planning is about 30 seconds worth of work of actual clicking buttons on a computer screen, saving a setting, changing a setting, right? It's very, very minuscule as far as the actual amount of work, but we have to talk about it for weeks on end. We have to plan for it for weeks and months on end, and we have to create, you know, projects, and we have to create all these change requests and all these things. I think that there's so much bureaucracy that gets in the way of progress. And one thing that I'm, you know, still trying to figure out too, just in at work in general, is how do you overcome those kinds of things? What are the best ways to not overanalyze things and not overplan for things and just execute, just get the things done and keep it simple? And I think that that's where, you know, a lot of companies, you know, drag their feet on things because they're overcomplicating things that really are very, very simple in nature. But there are instances where people want to question everything from top to bottom, left to right. They question it so much that they end up talking themselves out of doing whatever it was that they were going to do that was so great for the company. But they ask so many questions, they talk themselves out of it. And you still have to go back to, what are we trying to solve? What is the risk we're trying to fix? What is the risk we're trying to address? You will never eliminate all risk, right? So if you talk about something until you're blue in the face and you end up, you know, flipping the script on yourself and changing your mind about wanting to do whatever risk reduction it is because there's too many other risks that introduces, you can look at CASB, like I just discussed. You know, if you feel like CASB's just, oh, we're not going to do CASB now because we have to have all these SSL certificate pinned applications that are going to bypass it. So we're not going to do CASB at all. Well, now hold on here. What are you trying to solve? Like, what? There are a lot of other things that CASB can do outside of those certificate pinned applications. So you can't just isolate it to, you know, those one. You're still going to eliminate some risk. You can still have DLP controls. You can still plug in via API. You can still do a lot of other different things, right? So I think we hit this, you know, this crazy intersection of overanalyzing things to a level where we cripple ourselves. It's paralysis by analysis kind of thing. And then you end up not wanting to fix or do whatever it was because you've, you know, somehow talked yourself out of it. And I think the biggest thing that I've done and still continue to try to do is just keep it simple and try not to, when somebody tries to start coming in with all these questions about things, it's very hard to shut it down, right? Because they're, you know, wanting to answer, have all these questions answered. But you still have to try to keep it very, very simple and keep going back to the point of what you're trying to solve rather than, oh, I have to explain this to you, you know, at a level that, you know, that you know, anybody can understand. I get that, but they may still not understand it fully, right? So like managers, for example, or directors or whatever, whoever it is, VPs, you could be a CISO, a CIO, a CTO, whatever it is, when they want to start getting into the weeds on things and then start asking questions to the point where they confuse themselves and they don't understand what they're asking about, that creates problems because now you're putting your project on hold. You have to go meet with that, you know, manager, director, CIO, CTO, whoever it is, and explain it to them at, you know, the extreme technical level so that they get it. And then at the end of all that, they're always like, oh, okay, now I get it. Okay, you can continue. But in doing so, you have delayed your project and delayed your progress. And oftentimes getting on those people's calendars is an act of God, and it takes 3 to 4 weeks before you can even get a meeting with that person. So your project sits there delayed for 3 or 4 weeks until you can meet with that executive person, whoever it is, manager person, and explain it to them at the hyper technical level so that they get it. And this is what stifles progress. This bureaucracy and all the politics is what stifles progress. And it really creates, you know, a lot of headaches too, because now you're having to go back, re-explain everything at, you know, super in-depth levels. And then at the end of that, they're still like, oh, okay, cool, go ahead. Well, then what did we just do all this for? You questioned the heck out of this, and now you're saying it's okay. So at some point, you have to trust your people, trust what they're doing is right. I think the other biggest thing that I, besides trying to keep it simple, is setting solid deadlines on things so that, you know, if those higher ups come to you and say, I want to know this at a more detailed level, we need to meet about this, and you can't get on their calendar for 2 or 3 weeks, first thing you say is, well, sir or ma'am, our deadline is this Friday. So if we wait, we will miss our deadline. Are you okay with that? And are you willing to accept the risk? So you can fire back with things like that. And oftentimes that can help. And sometimes, you know, it may not, right? But I've had some success with that kind of thing. Explaining to them, hey, meeting with you is great. We can totally do that. Yeah, sure. If you want to get into the weeds, let's do it, right? But now we are delaying this project by another 2 weeks. And we're going to miss our deadline. So are you okay with that? And can we accept the risk in the meantime? They'll probably end up saying, oh, wait, it's going to delay the deadline? Oh, I have to accept the risk? Oh, okay, maybe not. I'll let you guys go. You may still have to go back to them and explain it some more, but I think we overcomplicate things in business to a level that is just crazy extreme. And really, it's the simple things. It's keeping it simple. Just do the basics. The basics are always what all these huge corporations need. They just got to get the basic controls in place. And so often we stifle that progress with all these, you know, politics and bureaucracy and all these approvals that you have to go through, and it has to go get 17 different approvals before you can buy a piece of software that's going to solve a problem, right? So anyway, I'm just, you know, trying to provide some sort of, I guess, insight and some workarounds for when you hit those situations, you hit those roadblocks. How do you get through it, right? Just try to keep it simple. You know, re-explain what your goal is, what you're trying to accomplish. And if they still want to get into the weeds on it, say, okay, well, we're going to miss our deadline. And are you okay with that? And then you might get a different story. Anyway, just some things that I've done that have helped me along the way. And, you know, I always seem to run into these kinds of things where they want to delay for really no good reason. And at the end of it, you still end up going through with it anyway and doing the work that you had originally planned on. But they create all these delays, you know, for, I guess, I don't know. Really, to me, it seems like no good reason, especially if you end up doing the project anyway. So it's a waste of time. It's a waste of resources. You know, time is money. But here we are talking about things for 2 and 3 months on end and talking in circles, and we have to have 15 different meetings to rediscuss everything that we've already figured out. So anyway, I hope that helps too with some folks and politics and bureaucracy that you may be running into at your organization. All right, folks, that's all I got for today. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll talk again soon.